So I'm happy to be here to talk to you about some work I've been involved with on frustrated diamond lattice antiferromagnets. Magnets. This was work that was done in the fairly recent past when I was here as a graduate student. So let me just acknowledge my collaborators first. So Jerome Bergman, he was a fellow grad student of mine, has now moved on to Yale. Leon Balenci, of course, is one of the organizers here. Emmanuel Gull, who's a numerical person at ETH Zurich, and also Simon Trebs, who's a member of Station Q on campus here. And so these guys were the ones who were responsible for the numerics, which I'll tell you about. And if you're interested, the reference for the work I'll be telling you about is down here. All right, so here's a brief outline of what I'll be talking about. So with this audience, you hardly need an introduction, but I'll just say a few words about emergent phenomena in frustrated magnetism to kind of set the stage. Then I'll say more specific things about diamond lattice antiferromagnets, and I'll give you an overview of some of the experiments which motivated us to think about these materials. Then I'll tell you about some theory that we developed for these systems. In particular, I'll tell you about a very simple J1, J2 model on the diamond lattice, which contains a lot of rich physics, I think. So I'll tell you about the ground states. It turns out that there's a highly degenerate set of such states in this model. There's interesting order by disorder physics that occurs here. I'll show you some Monte Carlo simulations which back up our analytical results and extend them further. And then I'll tell you about an interesting spiral spin liquid regime which occurs in this model. All right, so after that I'll try and tie this to existing experiments and hopefully convince you that what we've done is relevant for these materials and can provide some interesting future directions. Okay, and then I'll just finish with a summary and some final comments. Okay, so again, a slide like this isn't necessary for this audience. Let me just say that, in my view, the interesting thing about frustrated magnetism stems from a rather general principle, which is that if you have a system which has a lot of competing states, then often highly exotic and interesting physics can emerge in that type of system. So there's lots of classic examples of this, like the quantum Hall effect, high TC superconductors, and there's a myriad of context of materials in the context of frustrated magnetism which illustrate this principle nicely. So let me now just hone in on frustrated magnetism. So what frustration gives you oftentimes in a magnetic system is a set of highly degenerate ground states. Right, so some famous examples are nearest neighbor antiferromagnets on the pyrochlorokagamine lattice. Somewhat lesser known example is the FCC antiferromagnet, and there's many other examples as well. And in accordance with this general principle, a lot of interesting physics can emerge when one has a situation of having lots of degenerate ground states. And so I've listed some of these things here. So for one, such systems are often extremely sensitive to perturbations, which may be small, but they can have a big effect despite the fact that they may have a small associated energy scale, and that's because of frustration. So things like dipolar interactions or Zelazinsky-Mirre recoupling can become very important in highly frustrated systems and dominate the physics completely over certain energy scales. Another thing that's not uncommon to see is spin glass behavior emerging in frustrated systems. This is driven by disorder. Spin liquid physics can also occur either in the form of some exotic zero temperature quantum ground state or as some finite temperature parameter regime where a system has a lot of correlations. It's not mean field like necessarily, but nevertheless it doesn't have long range order yet. Okay, and finally I'll mention order by disorder. So order by disorder refers to the phenomenon where fluctuations, it could be quantum or thermal fluctuations, they stabilize long-range order in a system which otherwise would be disordered. Right. And this is so let me just comment briefly on order by disorder a little bit more. So this is this idea has been around for a long time and it's well understood theoretically, but I think at least as far as I know, there are no unambiguous experimental realizations of order by disorder, despite the fact that this is so well understood theoretically. Maybe people can correct me if I'm wrong about this, but one of the hopes of the work which I'll tell you about on these diamond lattice systems is that it may provide some concrete realization of order by disorder physics for experiments. Right. So all of these themes will actually recur later in the talk, so I just wanted to sort of lay that out briefly. Okay, so let me now just briefly review some generic experimental signatures of frustration. Okay. So if we have some magnetic system and we heat it up to very high temperatures above Curie-Weiss temperature, say, then the system is essentially behaving as some not interesting high temperature paramagnet, which is governed by mean field theory. Now if I lower the temperature and go to extremely low temperatures, what typically happens in the vast majority of cases is that the system develops some kind of long-range order. Okay, it could be magnetic order, Dymer order, or something of this type. Now, if the system was unfrustrated, you would expect naively that the long-range order should set in when temperature becomes comparable to the Curie-Weiss temperature, comparable to the exchange constant. But in a frustrated system, one can have a situation where TC is suppressed dramatically compared to the Curie-Weiss temperature. And when this happens, one opens up a broad so-called spin-liquid regime. Okay, and again, in this regime, the system doesn't have long-range order, but it's nevertheless, the system has significant correlations. And essentially, thermal fluctuations in this regime cycle the system through various low-energy competing states.
Yes.
Classical spin liquid, yeah. So it's quite different from a quantum zero temperature phase, which people propose in other contexts. Well, so I think of a quantum spin liquid as something which has TC zero. Okay. And so the mechanism here being that suppresses temperature down to zero is being quantum fluctuation. You know. So maybe Lan's point is that if you have some system and you perturb it slightly, then maybe there's a TC which is non-zero, but maybe there's a spin liquid regime which is still more or less governed by that quantum spin liquid. Yeah. So. That's true. So yeah, I've sort of been assuming a 3D crystal where you don't have such symmetry issues. Here. Yeah.
So this is currently stating that role of temperature is played by quantum fluctuations, zero point fluctuations.
So in a sense, I mean, I would agree with that. Yeah, so with that analogy, I think there's a very sort of precise analogy between temperature and, say, 1 over S or something like this. So maybe I should sort of back off on that statement.
My question is something which I've been worried about in various contexts. When can you say that this can be quantum? Is there a criteria that one can define by which one could say that this is a quantum spin liquid as opposed to a classical?
Well, yeah, I'm not sure I know a concrete answer to that question. Somehow, you know, things get a little bit fuzzy when you go to finite temperature. So naively, I would kind of I would be inclined to say that if you're thinking about temperatures below, say, exchange energies, you know, where the quantum nature of the spins is really playing a dominant role, then, you know, quantum effects are sort of the driving mechanism there over that temperature range. So. I don't quite know what to say. I think it's maybe not so clear cut a lot of the time.
some kind of coherence, quantum coherence over some length scale or something. Somehow your excitations are more, really quantum mechanical coherent excitation rather than
at any non-zero temperature, there's always some length beyond.
There's always some length.
Common classical.
Right.
And the question is whether what you're measuring is dominated by physics below that length or above that length. So the behavior of that length of temperature is very dependent on what the nature of the quantum ground state is.
How big should that length be? Should that length be smaller than 10 or
much bigger than the lattice space?
Is one lattice space enough?
Probably not.
Okay. So yeah. Certainly. So yeah. Well, it's good to discuss this. So maybe I shouldn't make a claim whether this region is quantum or classical. It's sort of. I don't really know how to define that in a precise way. For this talk, I'll be always thinking about this. Well, everything I'll say for this talk will be classical physics. But okay, so so a useful way to there's various ways that one can define frustration, but one way that I think is more useful for connecting to experiments, say, is to define some frustration parameter, which is the ratio of the Curie-Weiss temperature to the ordinary temperature. Okay, and typically, if you have a frustration parameter which is, say, greater than 5 or 10 or so, that's considered evidence of having a highly frustrated system, okay, because your TC is dramatically suppressed relative to your extremes constants. So now, if one has a system which fits into this rough schematic phase diagram here, the key challenges which you'd like to address in that system are essentially twofold. So first of all, one would like to know what's going on down here. So you'd like to know what the low temperature ordering is and what the mechanism that gives rise to that order happens to be. And again, this region can be sensitive to essentially all small scale perturbations which might be present in the system. And the second thing one would like to do is understand the correlations which govern the spin liquid regime up here. And in a sense, this provides somewhat more universal information, in the sense that a lot of the small scale physics which may be coming into play down here can be essentially washed out by thermal fluctuations. And so, at least from a theory point of view, this one has hoped to understand this spin liquid regime with sort of much simpler models than you might have to consider to understand what's going on down here. All right, so those are really the two sort of things one would like to understand, and that'll be the goal. Understanding those two points will be the goal for this talk in the context of diamond lattice systems. All right, now let me move to some of the materials which we are motivated by. So all the systems which we'll be thinking about here are so-called spinels, which have this generic chemical formula Ab2x4. There have already been a number of talks in this conference, in this workshop, which have focused on such systems. And the reason that they're typically interesting from a frustrated magnetism point of view is that these B-sites, they form a pyrochlore lattice, which is notoriously one of the most frustrated lattices that occur in nature. So a lot of, most work, I would say, has focused on the properties of spinels where these B-sites are the magnetic ions. So in this talk, we'll be focusing on rather different types of systems where actually the A-sites will be forming the magnetic ions, and those A-sites form a diamond lattice. Yes.
If you have low-energy excited states, mm-hmm. which have a different G-factor than the ground state, you will also get a shift of theta with respect to ordering temperature, which is then purely due to excited states. So is it not very dangerous to look at how frustrated the material is by taking theta over TC? Since, well, cobalt 304 for sure has low energy excited states, especially all the problem.
So you're imagining a system where somehow crystal field splitting is small compared to
Or the degeneracy and as well as coupling will lift things very long in the F systems to prevent all these cases of stability.
Yeah, so there may, it may be dangerous when thinking about such cases, but I think it's more reasonable when one has no orbital degeneracy and rather large crystal field splittings to use this characterization.
Yeah, and then you get past the normal coupling or some crystal, you get excited states that have a different G-factor that if you think into stability, that gives you a wide temperature, which has nothing to do with the ordering temperature. You have two states.
Yeah.
One state has one G-factor, another state has another G-factor.
Yeah.
At low temperature, you have the low G-factor, you get a straight line.
Yeah.
At higher temperature, you get the average of the two, so you get a different straight line. You can now extrapolate.
Yeah.
You get the delta.
Yeah.
And that has nothing to do with ordering.
Yeah. You're right. So you need to use other criteria. In that case, you know you're occupying more states. For instance, if you look at some data, you can identify in principle that there's more entropy.
Yeah, if I look at Bayesian cobalt 304 has this problem, iron scandium 204 should have this problem, cobalt rhodium 204 should have this problem.
This criteria is just indication.
Yeah, it's sort of a guide and it's useful in many contexts.
Which direction do you usually
You mean positive or negative data?
Yeah.
Depends on the
increased barren feedback or decreased.
It depends on less or more than half filled, and then if you have T2G,
for
it depends
on cobalt.
What was it? Cobalt is doing. Cobalt is making it negative, antiferro. But it's.
No, I mean, that due to this excited state, you get.
Oh,
which is different from a change direction. So, this
of if theta is positive or negative. Yeah, that highly depends on filling compared to crystal fields.
So there's no universal rule.
No universal rule.
I think in any case, the criteria by looking at this data, you would assume for those three examples on the left, those are probably not very frustrated. Maybe you would be making a mistake in one that might actually be.
It is, of course, when theta over TC is up from unity. You have to look at it, but first, there are more things than frustration that can give you a theta of DC that is not unity.
That's certainly true.
Yeah, so I mean, I would say just think of this as a guide. It's a useful guide. It's something you can easily measure in a lab.
In all these cases, is there an independent measure of gate?
Well, so if you have more information about what's going on, you can make more inferences about
other experiments.
Well, so we'll get to questions like that later. So certainly, if you have well-defined Kiri Weiss behavior, that gives and so it can be sort of delicate if you have, for instance, many exchanges. Say first, second, third neighbor, then you sort of just know the Kiri Weiss temperature gives you some sense of how large sort of the average is. And so then one can extract more detailed information if you know more details about the, say, low temperature ordering net events.
Yeah,
that
thing.
So sort of a direct experimental measure. I don't know about that, but so we can, using some theoretical analysis, we can step in and use the information from neutron scattering, say, to make. There is neutron scattering. Yeah. Well, for some of these systems, for the ones that I'll be talking about, there is. So, does that answer your question? But again, that requires some fitting to some theoretical model to do that. Okay. All right. So getting back to these spinels. So we're focusing here on spinels with magnetic A sites, which form diamond lattice and diamond lattice systems. There's been a lot of these compounds studied over the past several decades, really. And so here I have an axis which contains this frustration parameter, and I've indicated where a lot of these materials lie along this axis. And what you can see immediately is that there's enormous variation in the level of frustration which these materials exhibit. Okay, some like these three down here are, well, this one is essentially completely unfrustrated. These are sort of weakly so. And then there's more interesting materials, manganese cadmium sulfide and cobalt aluminum oxide, which display a rather strong degree of frustration. So this guy has frustration parameter of around 12. It's a little bit more delicate for the cobalt aluminum oxide because actually they don't ever see a true ordering transition, but rather there's some spin glass behavior that sets in. But one can use that as some guide for the frustration parameter, and that sets the parameter somewhere around 10 to 20. Okay, so there appears to be a rather strong frustration here as well. And as an aside, I'll note that there's another material, iron scandium sulfide, which is more frustrated by a factor of 100 than these other guys. And so its frustration parameter is somewhere around 1,000. It's one of the largest frustration parameters measured. And actually, that's just an upper bound because down to 50 millikelvin, you never see long-range order set in this material. And nor do they see evidence of spin glass behavior, at least down to 2 Kelvin. So just to give you some idea of what makes this material so different from these guys, it's useful to look at what the magnetic moments look like in these systems. So everything's happening in the 3D shell, and crystal fields split those levels into a lower doublet and an upper triplet. And for the manganese, Hund's rules just dictate that we fill the levels up like this, and we get a spin 5 Hasse moment with no orbital degeneracy. So similarly, in this cobalt, the cobalt ions form a spin 3 Hasse moment with no orbital degeneracy. But in the iron material, iron forms a spin 2, but with an extra orbital degeneracy. Okay, so it's presumably this orbital degeneracy which is making this material so much different than these materials here. And so in this talk, I'm going to just be focusing on the spin-only physics, because even for these spin-only compounds, there was very limited theoretical understanding. There's almost no theory done for these systems. Hopefully I'll convince you that even these spin-only physics have a lot of even these spin-only materials have a lot of interesting physics, and understanding these materials is certainly going to be a prerequisite to understanding this orbital and spin. So manganese scandium is around minus 20 Kelvin. This one, I believe, is around minus 50 Kelvin, and
some of the other ones, they're all kind of similar.
So these, they're all on the order of tens of Kelvin. Pretty similar.
Probably these effects you're talking about involving mixing
of
GGGG
require
being a much higher temperature
than
activator
or anything like that. Iron scandium, so before, when you include spinor or coupling, it becomes the same thing that Gramsci said. So
that one.
Well, the fields, the manganese and the cobalt should be okay.
Yeah. But the cobalt 3 or 4 then again has an open field program.
Right,
and the cobalt
but you need to activate across the big gap, right? Between
the G and G. As long as you're in 3D symmetry, the TGGs are degenerate. So then you don't have any gap. So then all the distortions below 3D symmetry or the spinolar coupling will give you some. And indeed, you have to activate above the gap. But
sorry, I thought this was associated with activation between EG and EG.
But Leon, you're thinking about this gap here?
If you look at iron scandium, then you have an open EG shell. But
yeah, iron scandium, I understand, but cobalt 304?
Cobalt 304 is, you have the cobalt in the T2G shift state, D7, so you have an open T2G shell, which is in principle degenerate, but the degeneracy is lifted by spin orbit coupling.
Yeah.
That gives you a huge difference in G factors.
And then it's the spin orbit splitting.
Yeah, it is the spin orbit, yeah.
Which is pretty small.
And then even if you have a state at, for example, 50 milliEV, you can get kinks down at 10 milliEV or so.
Well, at the end, that's possible. Right? And then you're at least at 50.
The current formula has to meet all the problems. You can't be simply solved by just realizing effectively that iron is simply a single state. You see, now the capital is simply become common mean. And then there are not much problems here. Correct?
Yeah, and it's even, you see it in susceptibility when you always have impurities, so it's not so easy to see, but when you make your magnetic field bigger and bigger, you measure M over H, you see that the low temperature just becomes constant from the length. So it's even, it's in agreement with experiment.
So it seems like a different explanation. I think it's a strange nature, but it's
interesting. Tell me why it's behavior really truly. Well, there is, you have a single ground state, and then at 2 milliEV or so, you get magnetic states. And so at high temperatures, you see normal Curie rise. But then at 20 Kelvin, you start to lose your magnetic moment. And at low temperature, you just have a single ground state.
The frustration must play some role, because the changes are not that small. And if you say we're not frustrated, it looks great. It's
absolutely true.
Combination.
And manganese has the same problem. This thing, if you include spinorbit on a single type, you call it a singlet. But then, of course, the magnetic moments are much bigger. And if you take iron and you replace scandium by something magnetic, then it also starts to order, just because the exchange field of
weather
puts it on the iron and then it's degeneracy, isn't it? You still have your tactile minus 50, but then when the quantica will lose your moment, so you have some frustration, but it's not lifted by distorting the letters or so, and then you're going into a symmetry.
That's interesting. Okay, so on the previous slide, the frustration which appears to be operating in some of these materials might look somewhat surprising, because the diamond lattice is bipartite. Okay, you can think of it as composed of two interpenetrating FCC sublattices. Okay, so I've colored those red and green here. And if we just write down the most naive Hamiltonian that we can write down, just some model with nearest neighbor exchange. Let me mention that I'll always be thinking of these as classical spins throughout this talk, because the materials that we're interested in have rather large spins. So if I take this most naive Hamiltonian, so it's clear that because of the bipartite nature of the diamond lattice, J1 just couples these two FCCs antiferromagnetically, and so there's no frustration in this model. Okay, I just write down the usual nail state, spin up on one sublattice, spin down on the other. This is a unique ground state that's perfectly happy. So something else needs to be included in order to generate frustration in these systems. And the simplest thing one can imagine doing is adding a further neighbor exchange, so in particular a second neighbor antiferromagnetic exchange, J2. Okay, so J2 couples nearest neighbors within each FCC sublattice, okay, and that forms triangular networks as shown here. So this generates geometric frustration and also competes with J1 and clearly frustrates this nail state. Okay. So we're going to consider this simple J1, J2 model. So we do this on a phenomenological basis, because this is the simplest thing which one can add to generate strong frustration. But it's worth noting that if one thinks about the actual exchange paths which connect nearest neighbor and second neighbors on this lattice, the ions are physically close. Nearest neighbors are physically closer than the second neighbors by quite a bit, of course. But actually, the exchange paths, which are the important thing, which connect the first and second neighbors, they're extremely similar. Okay, so unlike what conventional wisdom would suggest, in this case, there's no reason to assume that J1 is much larger than J2 in these diamond lattice antiferromagnets. And something along these lines was noted a long time ago by Roth, 50 years ago. Okay. All right, so let me now just consider this simple J1, J2 model. And first, let me ask what are the, let me sit at zero temperature and ask what are the classical ground states of this Hamiltonian. All right, so we know that for small enough J2, we just have the nail state as the unique ground state. And it turns out that this Snell state survives up to J2 over J1 equals 1/8. There's kind of a cute way to see why the ground state structure has to change here by writing. So what I can do is I can take this Hamiltonian and equivalently rewrite it in this form down here. So this first sum is over all such five-site simplexes of the lattice. And so there's this peculiar sum squared. And then when I write the Hamiltonian in this form, I have to add this effective second neighbor coupling, which has now a different prefactor, J2 minus J1 over 8. Right. So the Snell state will maximally satisfy this coupling here. So now let me ask what happens here. So if J2 is less than J1 over 8, then this effective coupling is negative. Okay, and the Snell state also maximally satisfies this term as long as that's the case.
1/8, is it a property of four coordinations?
I'm sorry?
Is it a property of four coordinations, 1/8? If I have another system with six coordination number, can I do similar?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you can sort of see that the reason it's 1/8 is because there's this 1/4. Okay, so but the moment we make J2 larger than J1 over 8, this coupling becomes effectively antiferromagnetic, and then this the Snell state no longer satisfies both of these terms, so something else has to happen. Okay. So what happens when you make J2 over J1 larger than 1/8 is, I think, quite remarkable. What happens is that the Snell state gets replaced by a highly degenerate set of coplanar spiral ground states. Okay, so each one of these degenerate spiral ground states is characterized by some propagation wave vector, which tells you how the spins rotate as you move along the crystal. And the remarkable thing about the ground states here is that these set of wave vectors, okay, which characterize spiral ground states, they form a two-dimensional surface in momentum space. Okay. So I'm going to call those spiral surfaces, and let me show you some examples. So this is coplanar spirals. They lie in a plane. Yeah.
And what's the plane they are in?
It doesn't matter. It's spin rotation. I'm sorry?
No relation between the Q vector of spiral and spin rotation plane.
So do you mean the plane that the spins actually lie in? So that's arbitrary, of
the
course.
Plane of,
So I'm not trying to understand. Maybe I'll just write down what the...
Yes.
Okay.
There's a model in there that's been ordered up in that separate spin rotation.
Is that what you're asking? Okay, so let me just show you some of these spiral surfaces. So this is what it looks like for J2 over J1 equals 0.2. So this thing just has some spherical topology. As I increase J2 over J1, eventually this surface touches the Brillouin zone boundary, and then I start to get holes developing around these 1-1-1 directions. So as I continue to raise J2 over J1, these holes increase, and eventually... Okay, so what I'm plotting here, let me set a J2 over J1 equals 0.2, for instance. So this surface here, I can take any wave vector along this surface, construct a spiral from that, a spiral which has that wave vector, and that will be a ground state.
The location of the wave vector?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
They don't mean anything. I'll show you such plots later on, actually.
Yeah.
At this level, yes. Yeah. Later on, I'll color these things according, which in a way which has meaning, but for now this is arbitrary.
The limit J1 equals 0 is like two decoupled FC lattice. Mm-hmm. So you still have a frustration, and what will be particular?
Exactly. So in the limit J1 goes to 0, then the surface just collapses onto a set of one-dimensional lines, okay, which you can sort of see happening here. And those one-dimensional lines are well known to characterize the set of ground states for just a pure nearest neighbor FCC anti-ferromagnet. Yeah, so it's kind of useful, I think, to, in a sense, consider this J1, J2 model in the diamond lattice as being kind of in between the FCC antiferromagnet and the pyrochlore antiferromagnet. So an FCC has lines of degeneracy, whereas a pyrochlore has, if I drew these same features for the pyrochlore lattice, the wave vectors would fill the whole Brillouin one zone. Okay. So this is kind of an example which is halfway between those two. All right, so that was the story at zero temperature. Now let me turn on some finite but small temperature and ask whether long-range order can occur in this model. Right, so it turns out that because we have this massive spiral degeneracy, stability of long-range order to fluctuations at any finite temperature is actually non-trivial. The reason that it's non-trivial is that, let me illustrate why that's the case. So we can, let me just choose some particular ground state to expand around. So this is just I choose some wave vector on the spiral surface, and this denotes the spin configuration. And then I just expand in fluctuations around that arbitrary ground state. Now at zero temperature, there will be a branch of normal modes for these fluctuations which has an infinite number of zeros. So in other words, there's some branch omega naught of Q which vanishes whenever I take the wave vector Q to lie on the spiral surface. So the physics of this is that if I start from some arbitrary ground state on this on the spiral surface, I can always smoothly distort the spins into any of the other ground states in the infinite set. That's why I have an infinite a surface of zeros. Okay, so now let me just naively use this branch of normal modes to ask how large the fluctuations are. And in this case, because of this surface of zeros, these fluctuations seem to diverge and diverge rather strongly. Okay. So this naive consideration would suggest that actually long-range order might not occur in this model. But in fact, this thinking is actually too naive. Okay. So this is the question: is there order by disorder? So there actually is order by disorder. Okay.
How does omega zero Q go as Q goes to zero?
At the zone center.
As Q goes to.
Oh, how does it go to Q squared?
The divergence in Q is coming from what?
So you have So I can focus only on Q near around this shell, around this surface. Okay, and so I'll get something that looks like dQ over Q squared. It's like a one-dimensional integral, and that blows up strongly. Okay, but as you just pointed out, the flaw in this argument is that there could be order by disorder, which occurs in this model. So the key idea is that in this branch omega naught of Q, the only symmetry required zeros are the Goldstone modes. Okay, and there's only two of those essentially. So this leaves open the possibility that thermal fluctuations can actually lift the remaining accidental zeros. And if this occurs, and if this lifting occurs strongly enough, then entropy would indeed stabilize long-range order. Okay, and this is. Usual arguments for what happens in order by disorder. Okay, so what we need to deduce whether or not this is the case, we need to get the finite temperature corrections to these modes everywhere on the spiral surface. And this is non-trivial to do because if one tries to do perturbation theory, which is the simplest thing you might try, you'll run into all sorts of divergences. So instead, one needs to resort to a self-consistent approach to get these corrections. And rather than show you any details, I'll just tell you the answer. Okay. So the answer is that, let me call omega t the thermally corrected modes. Okay, so one finds that omega t squared gets corrected by a factor which goes like t to the 2/3, okay, times some function of q. And the important thing is that this function of q, it vanishes only where it needs to at the symmetry required Goldstone modes. Okay. So now if I ask the same question, let me ask how large the fluctuations in the spins are, and let me now use these modified modes, then in fact this goes as t to the 1/3 rather than diverging, and so I can always set temperature low enough to make these fluctuations insignificant, and so long-range order shouldn't need to occur in this model. So it's interesting that one gets this non-analytic temperature dependence here. So this leads to various unconventional thermodynamic behavior. For instance, the classical specific heat gets enhanced to constant plus t to the 1/3 rather than constant plus temperature. And we can also naively quantize these modes. Okay, in that case, the quantum specific heat obtained in that way would give specific heat going like t to the 7/3 rather than t cubed. And this there are some, so it's a bit delicate to compare this result with experiment, but there are some of these diamond lattice systems which exhibit a t to the 2/5 behavior, or t to the 2.5 at small temperature, which...
Yeah. We're assuming some sort of static approximation when you got the answer, omega t squared q.
This...
the sigma q, why doesn't it depend upon the frequency?
So yeah, this is all just thermodynamic. Yeah, classical. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, one can imagine doing this kind of thing for a quantum system, and I imagine that you'd get something with 1 over S replacing T. Mm-hmm. But yeah, this is classical.
So that's been done like 2 years back.
For Kagame, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I have a question.
Yes.
So would this type of form of specific heat would be kind of generic for it? I mean, I can consider some system which may have the same surface of the energy. Would this just dictated by the dimensionality of the zero modes, this power law?
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah. I mean, this comes... All of this is just scaling, and it depends... Yeah, I mean, you can imagine pathological examples where it could be slightly different if you change the behavior of omega squared away from this. But yeah, I think it's fairly generic that you would get something like this for a two-dimensional surface.
And for instance, FCC, maybe you remember.
Oh yeah, so FCC. Let's see. So FCC, it's slightly different because you have lines. Okay. So you get log t squared or something, t log t squared. So it's some kind of nasty result like that.
And another question I have. Yeah. So if I expand around this sphere, mm-hmm. So the effective mass will be the same around the sphere. It will have some kind of...
There is dependence. There is dependence, and that'll be important. Actually, I think in the next slide.
There are no kind of the soft fluctuations.
For very special values of J2 over J1, there are there are points I believe where away from the surface it goes like q to the 4th rather than q squared. So yeah, I mean on the next slide, everything I'll say on the next slide comes into the fact that. This omega not squared away from the surface, it has only the discrete symmetries of the diamond lattice. So there's no reason to expect that it's somehow uniform across the surface. Okay. Yeah, that's an important point. Okay, let me skip this. Okay, so on the last slide, I showed you that we can establish quite generically that long-range order should occur in this model, but that's really only half of the puzzle. Okay, the other half of the puzzle, you'd like to know which state is actually selected by entropy, and this is directly related to the question you just asked. So this turns out to be a much easier question to answer, it turns out. So what we need to do in order to find which state entropy actually selects, we need to calculate the free energy for all wave vectors Q lying on the surface. Okay. So they'll all have the same energy, but they will have different values of the entropy. Okay. And the intuition that one usually has for this order, this entropic selection, is that entropy should favor the states which have the highest density of nearby low energy excitation. Okay. So, to get back to your question, it's the state which is sort of softest, the wave vector which has the softest fluctuations around that will be the one that wins typically. Okay. So we can calculate this for arbitrary J2 over J1. So now I'm going to show you those surfaces again, but this time color-coded according to free energy. Okay. So now the color means something, and just pay attention to the green points. The green points are going to be the positions with which are global free energy minima. Okay. So for J2 over J1 between 1/8 and 1/4, it's these 1-1-1 directions which are selected throughout this region. So as I increase J2 over J1, it's these points around the perimeter of the holes that develops which are selected. As I increase J2 over J1 further, it's these 1-1-0 directions which come out. And finally, for very large J2 over J1, it's points right around the 1-0-0 directions which are favored. Okay. So there's a rather complex crossover as you change J2 over J1. Okay, so that's what we know analytically for very low temperature physics. Now, if we want to go to higher temperatures and for instance get estimates for what TC should be, then we need to do Monte Carlo. And my collaborators Emmanuel and Simon are responsible for this part of the research. So it turns out that even though this is just a classical spin model, simulating it turns out to be non-trivial because you have this because of the presence of this surface. So what they did to improve thermal equilibration, they implemented some parallel tempering algorithm. I don't really know too much about this, but essentially you simulate different temperature points simultaneously and allow the system to swap between configurations between these temperature points. And that allows you to better sample this spiral surface. Because doing that with single spin flips could be very difficult because to go from one wave vector to another requires a big chain, a global rotation of all the spins. Okay, so this is the phase diagram that they obtained. This is the ordering temperature as a function of J2 over J1. So there's a lot of information here. Let me just start on the unfrustrated side. The first thing you can see is that this phase boundary for the Niel state drops extremely sharply as you ramp up J2. So right here, this is where the spiral surface just begins to develop. And just as an aside, it's somewhat interesting that the phase boundary for the Niel state actually bends to the right. So if I sit just to the right of where the spiral surface starts to develop and raise temperature, so there's a sequence of two transitions. So the Niel state is thermally stabilized to the right of where this spiral surface develops. Okay, so when you get some reentrant Niel state in that case. But the more interesting thing, which I want to focus on, is this whole region here. So indeed, these simulations find long-range order. They find this order by disorder physics. The TC is sharply reduced relative to the Curie-Weiss temperature. And one can do even a little bit more and check what the actual ordered states are compared to what we expect based on the previous slide where I showed you those color codings according to free energy. And indeed, those all agree with what we expect based on calculating the free energy. Okay, so this is in nice agreement with what we expected based on our analytic theory. But now we have more information which we couldn't get. We know what the TC is. We know that it's rather sharply suppressed. Yeah, so this curve looks a little bit funny. All these curves have lots of features. And the reason why you get these rather strong finite size effects is that in a finite system, you're approximating these surfaces by just some discrete set of points. Okay, and as you change your system size, you will have as you change J2 over J1 for a given system size, then the number of points which approximate that surface changes kind of dramatically. Okay, so that's why you get these a lot of these wiggles here. And
one can understand why in some cases the larger system size actually has a higher TC.
Yeah, I mean, I think way back when we tried to explain, you know, when the dips occur and when the peaks occur, and I think if you sort of just estimate how many points there are near the surface for a given system size, then that correlates very well with what you see here. Okay. Yes.
Transitions
are second order. It's strongly first order.
Strongly first order.
Mm-hmm.
Or on the nail side, it's
a
second order, and then it becomes.
Yeah. Okay. So now we know that order by disorder indeed occurs, and it occurs only at very low temperatures. So in accordance with the general discussion I had in the introduction, now there's a broad spin liquid regime, okay, between TC and the Curie-Leitch temperature. So for the next few slides, I'm going to focus on the properties of this spin liquid regime. So experimentally, you can probe this regime very nicely with neutron scattering and measure the spin structure factor. And the point I want to make on the next few slides is that the spin structure factor in this regime allows one to rather directly image both the spiral surface, which occurs in this model, as well as the entropic free energy corrections. Okay, and in other words, the spin liquid is a region should be an extremely good probe for essentially all of the physics which you predict should happen down here. All right, so now let me focus on a particular value of J2 over J1. I'll focus on 0.85, and the reason is that it'll turn out that this is the value which is relevant for manganese scandium sulfide. So this is the analytic free energy plot which I showed you before for this value of J2 over J1. So again, these green points are the order by disorder selected state. And to the right of that, I have the numerical structure factor. So what's plotted here, this is above the ordering temperature, okay? And this is what's displayed here is just the highest intensity points in the structure factor above some cutoff, and everything else is thrown away. Okay. And we use the same color coding scheme here and here. So the similarity between this numerical structure factor and this analytic free energy is pretty amazing, I think.
The numerical structure factor is above TC?
Above TC, yes. Where this is a, you know, sort of a low energy or very low temperature calculation. Yeah, it changes. I mean, you lock into some weird vector. It look completely different. Yeah, so it's important that we're above TC here. And this plot is for a temperature I think very close to TC. Okay. The point I want to make here is that not only does one image the spiral surface, but also you can resolve the entropic corrections along that surface. So this could be a rather direct probe for the physics that we've been describing here. And I'll just say that the free energy corrections which are visible here, they appear over a fairly narrow range of temperature between, say, TC and 1.3 TC. But the spiral surface itself is more robust, and you can resolve that over a much broader range in temperature between TC and 3 TC, roughly. Okay. So now in this regime between TC and 3 TC, I can appropriately characterize this regime as a spiral spin liquid because the physics is clearly being dominated by these low energy spiral ground states. Okay. Exactly. Yeah. And thermal fluctuations are sort of just cycling the system through the.
I mean, between the red and the green and the blue, what's the factor there? Is it of order 1 or is it of order 100?
I don't know the numbers, but so some idea for how large these splittings are, I think you can deduce from the temperature range over which they're visible.
Is it possible to see the factor T2 1/3 in the
So in principle, yes, but I understand that it's hard to actually extract that for numerically. I'm not exactly sure what the... do you remember what the problem was for numerics?
There are two problems. I mean, one is a small correction for the correction for the Bayesian terms. And once you go below density, which is where that's supposed to be, the equilibration becomes a problem. The size effects are really significant. So it's associated with fluctuating along the spiral, the spiral surface.
By any system, you know,
discrete points.
Mm-hmm. You see the structure matter directly, think at those points or at high temperatures, it's somewhere else, and then at low temperatures, it goes to these points. The question that Michelle was very interested in other points.
Something about the structure factor there?
So you're asking whether these maxima shift somewhere else.
At the function of temperature and only at low temperature you make.
Yeah, I'm not sure the answer.
But they're very weak now, so that's a
Something like 1 over temperature, I think, roughly.
1 over temperature?
Yeah. I don't think so, but yeah, it's roughly 1. So I can show you, I can tell you how that comes about. But, okay, so we can actually describe the spin-liquid correlations analytically in a quantitative way, as I'll now show you. So the method we use to characterize these the correlations in this regime is the so-called spherical model. Okay, so it sounds rather crude. So in the spherical model, one replaces the local unit vector constraint with some global constraint that just says the sum of the spin squared has to equal the number of sites. So although this sounds rather crude, it's known that the spherical model describes a spin liquid in other contexts, in the Kagami and pyrochlor spin liquids extremely well. And the same will be true here, as I'll now show you. So one of the interesting features that comes from the spherical model is that it predicts that the structure factor should exhibit data collapse. Okay, so what I mean by this is if I plot the structure factor as a function of versus this function of this particular function of momentum here, what it is not important, but it's some known function of momentum, then all the data points should collapse onto some one-dimensional curve. Okay, and so each one of these frames is a different temperature, so this is increasing temperature moving down. And these blue points are the Monte Carlo data. Okay, and you can see that these Monte Carlo points essentially do follow this trend line, basically a one-dimensional curve. And so you can see that, so there's some peak here, and this peak corresponds to values of the structure factor around the spiral surface. Okay, and you can see it, you can sort of see how it dies away, how it dies as you increase temperature. But sort of resolving, this doesn't tell you about sort of detailed questions like where the maxima occur. Okay, so we can actually, so that's the Monte Carlo points. Let me now show you. So this red curve, which I've superimposed, that's the analytical result from the spherical model. And it's basically perfect agreement with the numerics. And it's worth emphasizing that there's no free parameters here, really. There's just some overall scaling, which you never know anyway. To my knowledge, no. Somehow, as far as I know, there's no understanding why. I mean, it must be that somehow, so this is essentially large N. So somehow. Yeah, I haven't seen any such calculations, but. Yeah, as far as I understand, it's It's kind of like, you know, why does large S work when you truncate to S equals 1/2? Somehow, you know, corrections are small, and why they're small, I don't know. I wish I knew. So no, I've never seen anybody actually calculate those corrections for any of these systems. So.
That seemed to work better than correcting the last rated system. I'm not sure why, but maybe somehow there already is large degeneracy in low line states. The spherical model, that is that, because it's in more states than are there physically. By relaxing the system, maybe in a system that isn't very frustrated, that relaxing the system and normalization is really drastically increasing the predicted effective fluctuations. This kind of speculation.
Kind of amazingly, even for Ising spins, I think, which would be n equals 1, it does an amazing job. Yeah.
It only does well in high temperature phase. Mm-hmm.
So this this is another prediction which we can give some experimentalist all this information. We can give them a recipe for constructing their such plots and see if indeed their experimental structure factor data fall onto these curves and exhibit a static collapse. So this is really, I think, some non-trivial experimental test which can be used to show the relevance of our model to experiments. Unfortunately, one would need single crystals to resolve momentum in the structure factor, and those are not yet available, but hopefully sometime in the future we can get single neutron experiments, or sorry, single crystal neutron experiments. All right, so now I want to, so that's all I want to say about theory. So now for the next couple of slides, I want to apply that to experiments, okay, to the existing experimental data that's out there. So to do this, I need to think more realistically about what the Hamiltonian should look like. So in addition to these J1, J2 terms, which we've been considering, any experimental system will inevitably have some additional degeneracy breaking perturbations, which I'll just call delta H. Now, quite generally, we know that the entropic free energy corrections, they always vanish as temperature goes to zero. So this implies that these energetic corrections from delta H will always dominate the physics, provided you go to low enough temperature. Okay. It's inevitable. But nevertheless, if these perturbations are small enough, then you should still expect to see an order by disorder stabilized phase to appear at higher temperatures. Okay. Sort of when at temperatures higher. At temperatures high enough where these perturbations are essentially washed out, but low enough where entropic corrections are still stabilizing long range order. Okay, so with that in mind, let's look more closely at some of the results for manganese-scandium sulfide. So I'll start at the lowest temperature, at the lowest temperatures here. So below 1.9 Kelvin, what's known from neutron scattering is that the system orders into a spiral with this wave vector, with this nice commensurate wave vector. And they also know the detailed spin structure, so it's, I mean, this figure doesn't mean much, but they know really what the spins are doing. From this wave vector, as well as the detailed spin structure, we can immediately learn some things. There's immediately some theoretical implications of this. For instance, we know that in order to reproduce the spin structure which they find experimentally, we need J1 to be ferromagnetic. Okay, so that's one thing we know. We also know that in order for this spiral to be one of the ground states within our J1, J2 model, then we need J2 over J1 to be roughly 0.85. Okay. And the last thing that we learned from this is that the lowest temperature ordering is determined energetically, not entropically, okay, just like I argued must be the case on the previous slide. Right, so the reason is that entropy favors ordering along the 1-0-0 directions for this value of J2 over J1. Okay, so it's these green points. But experiments see a completely different spiral kicking in. So this point is along the 1-1-0 direction. Okay, so it can't be entropy that's giving rise to this lowest temperature state.
Is that why J1 is ferromagnetic here?
So If you look at just tracking the shortest hops that you have to make to connect J1, or to connect nearest neighbors, then there's a 90 degree bond angle. So you would, that suggests that J1 is ferromagnetic. But the problem is that you would also conclude that about J2. So I think that there's the actual mechanisms which give rise to J1 and J2 involve a lot of complicated things, which are probably not simple to calculate or to argue. I mean, it could. So there's the thing is that there's a lot of competing things that can happen. So you can go from just from nearest neighbor, from one nearest neighbor to another, but just by shortest hops. But that involves several intervening ions. Or you could go through fewer intervening ions, but you have to jump a larger distance. So somehow I think a lot of those things are coming into play. So if you just look at, in a sense, you can argue why J1 is ferromagnetic, but then you have a problem because J2 should also be ferromagnetic.
Yeah, I guess the really answer is that we can use the
So that's interesting. Actually, I'm.
The spin rotation axis is 101.
But this is true as long as the coupling constant is non-zero.
Well, how big is the
constant? I don't think there are any measurements of.
Yeah, I mean, so in this case, actually, I believe that experimentalists think that the spins lie in the AD plane. So in this case, I think that this argument of spin rotation symmetry is broken down somehow. So I mean, there could be such an effect there. Yeah, that's true. So. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there could be such a thing going on here. That'd be interesting. Okay. So now let me move to somewhat higher temperatures. So what happens as you raise temperature above 1.9 Kelvin? There's I think a fairly mysterious phase. There's another phase transition at 2.3 Kelvin, which I think I don't quite understand. But what's seen in this region between 1.9 Kelvin and 2.3 Kelvin is again spiral order with the wave vector close to this, coexisting with a lot of diffuse scattering around, with wave vector magnitude around 2 pi.
But the typical situation for many systems is that the higher temperature is a sinusoidal, and then low temperature becomes spiral.
It's possible. I mean, what I would like to say is that somehow this is associated with order by disorder, but. Yeah, I mean, I would say that this is. Yeah. I mean, my preference would be to. My hope is that this is somehow in entropically driven. Driven order, and this is an energetically driven order, but we don't have enough information. There's two phase transitions. Exactly what the difference is between the two phases, I think, is not clear. Mm. But you see clear kinks in specific heat and susceptibility at these two temperatures. Okay. So if we go above 2.3 Kelvin, the spiral order dies, okay, and then one is just left with the same diffuse scattering which persists around this wave vector 2 pi. And then eventually this, you just get a boring paramagnetic behavior. All right, so here's some of the data that illustrate this crossover. So this is the experimental intensity as a function of wave vector magnitude, and increasing temperature is down this way. Okay. So at the lowest temperatures, one can see that the structure factors peaked right around this wave vector. And as you lower the temperature, the intensity shifts to slightly lower wave vectors, and this is this wave vector 2 pi. So we can actually account for this generic behavior within our model by adding a small anti-ferromagnetic J3. Okay. Actually, I'm not sure I said this, but so this ordering, the ordering that they actually see, you can get that very naturally by adding a small anti-ferromagnetic J3. I think I forgot to say that. So that's the reason we're adding a small anti-ferromagnetic J3 here to try and understand this crossover.
And the frustration remains, so or you unfrustrate the system?
Well, I would say that the frustration remains. I mean, it depends on sort of how you define frustration. But so you very weakly, if you add a small J3, you've weakly broken the degeneracy around the surface. But so that degeneracy breaking is only significant when you go down to very low temperatures where J3 hasn't been washed out essentially by thermal fluctuations. Okay, so this is a similar kind of a powder average structure factor as a function of wave vector transfer with a small J3. Again, increasing temperature corresponds to moving down this way. And you can see a clear shift in intensity, just like they find experimentally, from this wave vector, which is the state which is picked out by J3, down to this slightly smaller wave vector, which is 2 pi. And this is the wave vector, sort of the average wave vector for this spiral surface. Okay. All right. So this intensity shift is indeed consistent with temperature washing out J3, the energetic correction due to J3, and leaving just the sort of bare spiral surface. Okay. So I think this is a nice indication that what we've done is actually relevant and makes some good quantitative connection with experiments on manganese scandium sulfide. And so now briefly, let me just say something about cobalt aluminum oxide. Much less is known here. Actually, if you, as I said earlier, if you, there's no long-range ordering transition. Rather, there's some spin freezing that occurs at low temperatures. Nevertheless, there is some indication of strong frustration, and there is some powder neutron data, which is rather noisy. This is intensity as a function of wave vector transfer, and this is data taken inside of the spin glass phase. Okay, and it's so noisy that you can, I mean, some of the features are kind of garbage, but you can see that there is some well-defined, there are some prominent features in this curve. Now, we can model this rather nicely by assuming that J2 over J1 for this material is right around 1/8. Okay, so that's right where the spiral surface begins to develop. And I can calculate the same kind of structure, power to average structure factor as a function of momentum. Assuming that this is the case, and indeed it looks, I see the most prominent features reproduced in this theoretical curve. So this suggests that, so here's again my global phase diagram obtained from Monte Carlo. So this tentatively would place cobalt aluminum oxide somewhere right around the transition where the nail state first gets destroyed and you begin to develop the spiral surface, while manganese scandium sulfide occurs at a much larger value of J2 over J1, where this surface is really well developed. And so just as an aside, I think this raises an interesting question which we've started thinking about along with Lucille Savary, who's visiting here for a while, pertaining to the effects of disorder in these systems. Okay. So somehow, clearly disorder is important for cobalt aluminum oxide. It's driving some spin glass phase. Whereas manganese scandium sulfide is either less disordered or less prone or less influenced by disorder. So we hopefully this result this work on this on disordering the diamond lattice antiferrous magnets will be available soon. But if anyone's interested, I can talk afterwards about that. Okay, so that's the end of my talk. Let me just summarize. So I've told you that there are lots of spinels, A-site spinels, which constitute frustrated diamond lattice antiferrous magnets. The ones I focused on here are manganese scandium sulfide and cobalt aluminum oxide. To try and understand the physics that's going on in these materials, we've considered a simple J1, J2 model, which we think is capturing really the essential physics of these materials. And it has a lot of, I think, quite remarkable features. There's this continuous spiral ground state degeneracy. There's interesting order by disorder physics, an interesting spiral spin liquid phase, which really allows one to directly probe both of these phenomena. And the theoretical predictions that we have are, I think, nicely consistent with existing experiments, particularly with manganese scandium sulfide. Okay. So the most let me just say that what we really like is some single crystals, and I think these experiments will be pursued. And if one did have single crystals, then that would allow for a much more direct and quantitative comparison with our theory, and perhaps this may lead to some concrete experimental realization of order by disorder. So that's kind of the broad hope. So with that, let me just conclude. Thank these people for sharing insights, and thanks for your attention.
Thanks, Bill. I have actually one question. Maybe it's not related to the history or story, some problem. Some of them, maybe that's not really magic. But superficially, I think that there is a famous system which was very popular in connection with quantitative algorithms for the behavior with non-infinity. Actually, if you look at the structure, it's also basically just some kind of a depth algorithm, like five members, 10-member ring. I don't really know why there is theory of five of six, but the claim of experimental thinking from people is either mostly determination on the previous one of the theory. Then they claim that when you go and the pressure of this non-terminated state, then you initially have normal pressure effect in particular spiral particular direction. And then you kind of have spiral which keep more or less Q vector the length, but the Q vector can be in different directions. There are something like a surface in which a Q vector may be a kind of pieces of snake spiral, but in different parts of sample, we have different orientation of different Q vector. I just wonder, which is kind of superficially kind of resembles and what was there.
Yeah, I don't know too much about that story, but
maybe interesting for you to look from your point of view of these things, because from what I know, at least I didn't hear any clear explanation on why this can happen, why this happens.
Yeah, I mean, I.
I mean, it probably has nothing to do with frustration in the sense.
Maybe not.
Because the diameter of the spiral is very small, so the spiral wavelength is 150 angstroms or something.
Yeah, it might be that it's the old Newton velocity theory is like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Whether there might be some, nevertheless, some similar fluctuation physics, just because of this nearly degenerate surface, that's a possibility. That's a small monad system, for instance.
At least the picture that I draw, I guess.
Yes, it looks very similar.
Looks similar. I don't have any deeper arguments, actually.
Magnetic field does
in this situation of the disorder. It diminishes entropy, so DC drops.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not sure we haven't thought about magnetic field effects, but
experimentally.
I mean, I think whether TC drops depends on how sort of the difference in entropy, the entropic corrections around the spiral surface, and I don't know.
I think that's probably true for the J1, J2 model, and TC would basically drop. Yeah, and there's some small shifts in the wave vector, as you put a field on, so that can also change things. I mean, experimentally, in only experiments I know are in this magnetic scanning so far, which has some negative crystalline in isotropy, which is ultimately locking in the wave vector. That the behavior in a field there is really, at least low fields, is being dominated by that. So they see some kind of spin flop transition in the field of Tesla, which you will not get that in this J1, J2 model. You need corrections. You need some anisotropy. I've actually with a student thinking about that. Try and get that behavior from a even more phenomenological Landau theory treatment of crystal that's possibly also sorry.
Is that published? No, I mean the experiment.
No.
I have a question. For example, so is it case when you end up with a situation when you have selected by the order by disorder some momentum states on this surface, but they are still degenerate because in the sense that it's they are non-equivalent Q states, but related to the by the lattice symmetry operations. Can you then further find out which Q or the linear combination of multi-Q states and things like that will appear or at this level?
Yeah, so that's a good question. So what I can say is that if you try and superimpose different wave vectors and if you try and produce a classical ground state, it's extremely unlikely that you'll be able to do it in the sense that you try and write down a state which has a unit vector constraint enforced at every site. Okay. You can do this for a single spiral very easily, but the moment you try and mix in different wave vectors, it's essentially you can't do it. You can't mix in two wave vectors and have a good classical state. So if you just have a single spiral, then it'd be arbitrary. The system just selects some particular directions. But it turns out that if you add impurities, then this rotation symmetry gets broken, and you may favor particular directions.
There's no need to consider like a couple between these different Q vectors to see. I mean, like in
so it won't be in a lot of state microscopically.
This is not a Ginsburg-Landau analysis. Right? This is just a microscopic analysis. At low temperature, you're guaranteed you have a classical model, which are basically full moments, and then you can't do that with a multi-Q state. Potentially, near a phase transition, if there were a lot of fluctuations, you could have a multi-Q state. Fluctuations would reduce the momentum. But it probably doesn't happen here because the transitions are strong in the first order. So you get into a rather well-ordered state once you get the phase. So I would say that if you were to try and get it from Ginsburg-Landau point of view, interactions between the different Q modes would be such that they fail in single Q states. So many people have proposed different things concerning these psilocybe.
So it can be quantum tunneling from one Q state to the other one.
Classical
mode. Yeah, that's good. Enjoy your hand.
I'm not sure what you mean, I suppose it's a small system.
Wouldn't that be kind of like a Schrodinger cat somehow? I mean,
yeah, it's huge.
I have a kind of comment. I'm sure probably you are aware of, you know, this study by Brazovsky, that's quite an old work about the crystallization of, how it's called, you know, So where you have these same spheres and these fluctuations, there is a transition to first order. So this is similar to what's happening here, for the transition becomes a first order essentially.
Yeah, I mean, there may be some.
It's not surprising when it's first order.
Yeah,
it's not surprising. You have a nearly degenerate surface.
Dr. Gresham, what is the general maybe? What is the effect of phonons? The effect of vibration, reflex vibrations, spin phonon interaction. If these ions vibrate, so in any given moment, the triangle is not equivalent. So you can have all exchange interactions are different. And then you can satisfy minimum energy. Does it mean that frustration will disappear if you include phonons?
Well, I phonons will certainly lift this degeneracy. So, you know, I think it's a question of how strongly they lift it.
Well, sometimes we discuss how to
details of spin lattice coupling, how strong it is, what its nature is. Really simple, immunostrictive coupling. I think it does not completely meet the degeneracy.
Why not? I mean, don't you get quartic terms or somehow? Or do they just sort of average out somehow?
Well, they're not so easy to satisfy either. The zero order, they like collinear spins in the zero order end to end. It's highly non-collinear spins. It's not like it just naturally picks some particular subset. Yeah, I would say that's something that we looked at to try and one of the questions we've mentioned is commensurate order and many of the scales. We're trying to understand that microscopically. One thing we looked at was spin lattice coupling. It played a role. Didn't seem to. What's known from neutrons is really not consistent with what the simplest model of spin lattice coupling would look like. So, probably not the dominant effect. Looks like we're done. Any more questions? Thanks, everybody. George scheduled another.